All right. Well, let's go ahead and talk about your book. Annalie, when you talk about mass extinction, what exactly does that mean? I mean, not your everyday, ordinary cataclysm, but something very specific?
Yeah, it's actually a very slow motion cataclysm in some ways. It's when 75% or more species on the planet go extinct in about a million years. So it's something that is very fast in geological time, but very slow from the perspective of an individual lifespan. And there have been five of these events on Earth over the past half billion years or so.
Can't some of them happen fast? I mean, like the mass extinction, the meteorite that wiped out the dinosaurs?
Actually, it's kind of a misunderstanding of how these events work that we imagine them happening really fast. Oftentimes, something like the meteorite that was partially responsible for killing off the dinosaurs, it's viewed as being this giant explosion that, you know, wrapped the Earth in fire and, you know, everybody died instantaneously. But actually what happened was, of course, there were localized deaths near the impact site. But the real damage came in the coming centuries as all of the toxins and dust that were kicked up by that meteorite strike started to change the environment. And specifically, it caused really dramatic climate fluctuations that ruined habitats for many different dinosaur species. So what you would see is initial deaths and then a slow shift in the climate. And over time, many, many more species died out. And so at the end of a million-year period, you're looking back and you're seeing about 75% of all species dying out. But that didn't happen right away.
Well, that's a little scary to hear about now, because it sounds like there's a very direct correlation between environmental change and mass death. So given global warming and the related environmental changes that we're living through right now, is this the beginning of the next mass extinction?
It's a real possibility, and there's a lot of environmental scientists who are concerned about this, because when we look back at the geological record and we look at those five previous mass extinctions, there really is a strong correlation between climate changes and climate fluctuations and these horrific mass extinction events. And, of course, we are in a period of climate change right now on the planet. There's no telling whether this is going to be a long-term climate change or not. But it is a very dangerous sign. The other data point that environmentalists are concerned about is that we're seeing elevated levels of extinction among land animals. So when you put together the numbers of animals who are going extinct, which is far above what we would expect, along with climate changes, it does start to look like we might be in the early stages of a sixth mass extinction. And it's possible that that extinction may have started about 15,000 years ago with creatures like woolly mammoths dying out. So that might have been the first wave of extinctions that we see on land. And so we really might be several thousand years into it.
So meanwhile, here we've been going all about our everyday business, thinking everything's just fine and the world is going to stay the same way. And meanwhile, things have already started to go downhill.
Yeah, the world never stays the same way. That's the thing that geology teaches you, is that no matter what, even if humans weren't here, the world would change dramatically without us. There would be asteroid strikes or megavolcanoes. The climate is always shifting. And, you know, for most of Earth's history, we didn't even have ice at the poles. So having ice at the poles at all is kind of a novelty for the planet.
So if this is the next mass extinction that we're already some thousand plus years into, how's it likely to play out, do you think?
So it's probably going to be a situation where we're going to see more and more animals go extinct. And it's going to be driven probably by things like habitat destruction. So we have climate changes going on. That leads to ocean acidification. When you load the environment with carbon, that causes the ocean to become acidified. And so that ruins habitats in the ocean. And meanwhile, on land, we're seeing all kinds of ways that habitats get destroyed, everything from human development to climate change, transforming the way plants can grow and things like that. So what you'd likely see in the long term is a lot of famine and starvation. Because when environments change, what actually happens is animals don't get enough food to eat, and plants don't get enough access to the kinds of temperatures they need and things like that. So likely we would see more and more die-offs as a result of habitat change. And then as more animals are dying off and as more plants are dying off, any animals and plants that depend on those creatures that have died out, well, those are going to die out too. We call that a knock-on extinction event. So the more animals that die, the more that they die, because they all are dependent on each other in an ecosystem.
This is why there's a noise.
Wow, now we're having an emergency.
We're having a fire alarm. I don't know if you can hear it on the air or not.
Yep, we can.
Yeah, I can hear.
Can?
Crap. Yes.
All right, let me see what's going on. I think it's just a test, which they didn't tell us.
Okay.
But I need to know.
Yep.
Okay.
Let me find out.
Okay. We'll wait.
That's dramatic
and very appropriate given the subject.
I started seeing this flashing light, and I was like, what's happening?
Hey,
and then more and more animals would die.
And mass starvation and death. And then the
If it's a test, it's going to last like 10 minutes. So let me see if I can find some info.
Yeah, it does kind of sound like the zombies are coming.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to make noise. Oh, there we go. It's done.
Okay. Yay.
Okay. Definitely we're done.
It looks...
Yeah. Lights are off and everything. So there you go.
Okay. Dramatic. Okay.
So I think what I was about to say was, so this is why everybody's so worried about the bees, for instance. If colony collapse disorder continues and the bees get wiped out, there are some immediate consequences.
Yeah, that's right. Bees are a really good example of a species that if it dies out, we're going to see a lot of die-offs among, you know, some of humans' favorite foods, like apples, for example. We depend on bees to fertilize a lot of our basic crops. And so if we don't have bees, all of those crops also are going to suffer. And possibly it'd be very, very difficult for us to farm a lot of the fruits and vegetables that we depend on for our meals. Mm. So that's a very big part of what we worry about, is how extinctions tend to pile up on each other.
Well, so far, this is a pretty gloom and doom story about the future or lack of future. And yet you call yourself a techno-optimist, and your book, the subtitle is How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. So why did you wind up being optimistic about this?
I would actually say I'm more of a geological optimist than a techno-optimist.
You mean the rocks will survive, but we won't?
I mean that if you look at what's going on the planet in geological time and in geological terms, there are a lot of causes for guarded optimism. One of them is just that humans are likely to survive a mass extinction, which doesn't mean that things are going to be easy. If the planet actually goes through a mass extinction and we survive, as many species before us have survived mass extinctions, it's going to be an incredibly tough time. And as I said, there's going to be famines. There's going to be incredible difficulty with climate fluctuations. It's not going to be fun. But we have a lot of the characteristics of a survivor species. We're very adaptable. We can live in a changing environment. We are good problem solvers. We're able to pass ideas along to each other very quickly, which is something that, as far as we know, only humans can do. So we're very well equipped to deal with this kind of disaster. My hope comes from the fact that, as I mentioned, humans aren't just good animals at surviving. We have this uniquely human ability to solve really big problems. And when humans figured out about half a century ago that there were things called carbon cycles and that, in fact, we were entering into a phase where the climate was changing because of how much carbon had been loaded into the atmosphere, it very quickly became an international political issue. And you may say, well, you know, it's taken so long and why aren't people doing anything? But given that we've only known about this problem for basically a generation or two, I think that humans are doing a pretty good job as a species of trying to address it. And my hope is that over time, we can use what we've learned from geological history and use our science and our technology, I suppose, to deal with this problem. And I say technology, I suppose, because I think that a lot of the solutions to the climate problems that we're going to be facing may not look like technology as we know it. I don't think we're going to use giant machines to solve this problem. I think we're going to have to learn how to create science and technology that behave more like part of the environment and that are not destroying the environment.
Well, let's talk about some of the particular reasons you feel optimistic. For instance, you're kind of high on the potential in algae.
I am. I love algae. blue-green algae specifically, which is actually cyanobacteria. It's it was classified as algae kind of incorrectly, and now we know it's a form of bacteria.
Isn't that the stuff that grows in farm ponds that we're all supposed to avoid?
It's it looks like scum on top of the water. So you don't. It's not. Some of it is actually. Some species of it can be a little bit toxic. But the blue-green type, that's that blue-green color, is just fine. You can go and pet it and have a conversation with it if you want. the thing that's great about cyanobacteria is that it's one of the world's most powerful survival species. It has survived every single mass extinction on the planet, and it's done it for two reasons. One, it's incredibly adaptable. And two, it's figured out a way to live almost anywhere on the planet by inventing something that humans have just invented really recently, which is solar power. And these creatures are the very first photosynthesizers on the planet, as far as we know. Billions of years ago, they started using sunlight as a form of energy and have continued to do that. And in fact, plants evolved by using cyanobacteria and incorporating it into their cells in order to do photosynthesis themselves.
So is there a way that we humans could figure out how to tap algae's capabilities?
Yeah, there's scientists right now who are working on doing that in two ways. One would be to use technology to imitate how photosynthesis works and to create solar fuel generators. And there's a number of labs that are doing that. There's also labs that are working on using the algae itself to do things like create hydrogen fuel. So actually turning the algae into a part of a biological device. And those are both incredibly hopeful outcomes for science. And I think especially looking at how to change algae into something that we can use as a building block for solar-powered cities, for example, is a very interesting way of looking at how our technology might change in the future to be more like the natural environment. A lot of people are looking at synthetic biology as being a way of building new kinds of cities and new kinds of machines.
So it sounds like we would be able to essentially grow our own fuel?
Yes, we would. In fact, I talked to some scientists at the University of Washington. I talked to some scientists at Washington University in St. Louis who are working on this exact idea that we would be growing fuel in giant vats, kind of like a brewery, is what they said. It would be just basically a place where you're cooking up big vats of algae that would be part of your fuel source. And other scientists are looking at how you could modify cyanobacteria to do other kinds of things, like water filtration is one idea. Converting them into sensors is another. And it's all part of a larger project that we see going on partly in the area of synthetic biology and partly in architecture and city design, where people are really thinking about how can we start building with living materials? Mm. How do we make our cities carbon neutral by having energy that's carbon neutral, but also a lot of the different metabolic functions of the city, like water filtration, for example? How do we make that into something that's more like the natural environment rather than a machine-based environment.
Now, in popular culture, when we tell stories about the end of the world or the coming apocalypse, a very common trope is the abandoned, weed-infested concrete ruin of a major city. Half the world's population does now live in cities. But as you pointed out in the book, cities can also be death traps during disasters. Will cities be just abandoned while human survivors live in the wild, do you think, or are there ways we could save them?
I think it really depends on what you mean by a disaster. So I think in certain disasters, cities will be abandoned. But the kinds of disasters that I'm looking at, things like mass extinctions, which are really these slow motion disasters that have a lot to do with the environment and the climate, I think cities will actually be the main place that we're going to want people to live, because cities allow you to have an incredibly good economy of scale for resource distribution and for energy use and for food distribution. All kinds of resources become more available when you have more people in a smaller area, because you simply have an easier time distributing it. So you're not expending a lot of energy bringing fuel out to remote locations or bringing food out to remote locations. You've got people there. And if you're building in a carbon neutral way, and if you have cities that are designed around things like public transit, you really can have quite a nice futuristic society that's based in a city. And of course, that also includes trying to build the cities in ways that allow them to be sustainable, maybe building with new kinds of materials like self-healing concrete, self-healing steel. These are all things that scientists are thinking about now. How do you build a building that repairs itself so you don't have to tear it down and build a new one? So, and I think that's really a vision that we need to be thinking about, because realistically, most people are living in cities, and it's predicted, the UN has predicted, that more and more people will be coming to cities. So when we focus our efforts on how to create a more sustainable future and really a more survivable future, we need to think about, how do we want to retrofit our cities? How do we want to build and rebuild our cities so that more people can live there comfortably and use the resources available to them in a way that's carbon neutral?
Well, you've also explored the concept of underground cities as possible future human habitats. What do you mean by underground cities?
So basically, one possibility for an end-of-the-world scenario that might cause a mass extinction, so it wouldn't be the end of the world, but it would be the end of many species, is that we might have a radiation disaster of some kind. It might be radiation coming from space because a supernova explodes nearby and shoots a bunch of gamma rays at us. It might be some kind of nuclear war that humans cause. Either way, you're dealing with an environment that's saturated with radiation. Even a volcano can do this, actually. A large volcano could really drive people underground as well. So the question is, how do you continue human civilization underground? It sounds like a total dystopia, you know, the ultimate idea of, you know, this is the end of humans. We're all living underground and worshiping atomic bombs or whatever happens in the Planet of the Apes movie that we all wish we hadn't seen.
Or so, we become like moles, you know, blinking in the dark, or pod people living underground.
Exactly.
In bunkers.
Yeah. It brings up all of these negative images. And I actually spoke with a lot of underground designers about, well, what would we do if we wanted to survive underground, but in a way that wasn't completely horrific? And there's a couple of really simple ways that people who design underground structures have found that help people cope with living underground, because there's a lot of places, especially in cold cities, where there are huge numbers of shops and train stations that are all underground, and you can kind of live underground if you need to because it's just really cold. And one of the main things is creating areas that look distinct from each other. Because when we design underground spaces, we always think of those bland corridors that all look the same. Every door is the same color. Every hallway is the same size, because that's just what we've generally seen in underground design. But when you design a space with areas that look like neighborhoods, so one particular area in your underground city might have a different kind of design scheme, different kind of paint, different layout, different ways of designing the stores and the houses, that really helps people feel more oriented, because they feel like they're going into new spaces and they're getting stimulated in new ways, and they're able to navigate those spaces and be more socially comfortable in them. And that's a really simple thing that we can think about. If we have to move underground, how do we build it so people aren't feeling like stabbing their eyes out because they're trapped underground?
I don't know. So it still sounds like we become moles. We're just happier moles.
hey, moles are really happy.
Well, what about using technology not just to help us survive climate change, but to fix it or to alter the climate in ways that we want? I mean, you looked into geoengineering, for instance.
That's right. There's a lot of thought going into how we might do geoengineering projects, which are basically projects using either technology or different kinds of techniques to draw carbon down out of the environment so that we're not just being carbon neutral in our production, but we're actually pulling carbon out of the environment. And there's also another set of ideas about how we might make our atmosphere more reflective so that we would be pushing more sunlight back out or bouncing more sunlight back out into space. So either way, the goal is cooling the climate down by changing the entire climate of the whole world. And this is very futuristic technology, obviously, something that we really probably wouldn't see for at least 100 years. And there are a lot of ethical questions about it. If you start messing with the weather and you start messing with temperatures that are going to affect the entire planet, what kind of governmental body is organizing that? Is it the UN? What is it? So
yeah, I could imagine there would be a lot of potentially disastrous, unexpected consequences. But is there a particular geoengineering project or concept that you really love?
Yeah, I think that one of the ones that made a lot of sense to me came out of the Oxford Martin School, where they have a whole group of folks who are looking at the potential for geoengineering. And they believe that it's possible that we could create artificial weathering. And what that would mean is basically recreating the Earth's natural process for drawing carbon down out of the atmosphere. So naturally, over time, the Earth is weathered. Mountains wear down. The Earth is pounded with rain and wind. And slowly, carbon is pulled into small particles of Earth and small particles of rock and washed out into the ocean and sinks to the bottom of the ocean, which is a carbon sink. So what if we could speed up that process of pulling carbon down, you know, pulling it in with wind and rain? And there's a lot of different ideas about how we might do that, including something like literally spreading very, very fine rock out over a very large area and kind of washing it into the ocean. And again, this is not a form of pollution. This is basically just accelerating a natural process. And we don't know for sure if it would work. It's very hard to test right now. We're just in the stages of thinking about whether it could be done. But I think something like that, where we use the planet's own process to pull carbon down more quickly, that seems to me like a really good way to go. Turning the planet itself into a kind of technology, I think, is really what we want to be thinking about, rather than building giant devices that might suck carbon in. I think we need to think outside the box. And that's one example of how scientists really are trying to tackle this in a way that is using the natural processes rather than trying to intervene in some other way.
Now, on the other hand, I've talked with other scientists who do future modeling who say that there's practically no doubt in their minds that the only way the human race is going to survive is if we colonize other planets. What do you think?
I think that we will survive even if we don't colonize other planets, but I think that we are going to want to colonize other planets. We're great explorers. I think that when humans are exploring, most often it brings out our best impulses as a species. We're very good at remaining in touch with each other over vast distances and making great discoveries and adapting to new places. And I think I hesitate to say natural, because none of this is particularly natural, but I do think it makes sense for us to continue the kind of exploration we started when we left Africa, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, and started exploring other parts of the planet. I think it's a dream for many people. It offers people hope that humans will continue to change and evolve. And I think it's a very good goal to have, because I think if we set as a goal that we're going to colonize space, That's going to help us develop a lot of technologies that will help us survive on Earth, like geoengineering technologies and like technologies for living in an environmentally sustainable way, which is exactly what you would have to do in order to ride in a spaceship to another world. You would need a way to have a sustainable environment in the ship. You would need a way to geoengineer that planet to make it habitable for humans. And, I mean, as long as nobody else is using that planet,
key point.
Is a concern. please don't use planets that are already being used. Right. So I think that it works well as a goal scientifically and also emotionally for people. Mm. And it's also a reminder that this isn't the final stage of Homo sapiens. We evolved from another species about 200,000 years ago. We're going to evolve into other species in the future. And if we colonize other worlds, that's going to be one way that that kind of evolution might happen. Because as we adapt to new environments, we are going to evolve and change to be better suited to those environments.
Well, on the other hand, the big barrier, of course, to exploring other planets and colonizing other places in outer space is just getting there. You write about this concept called a space elevator. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So a space elevator is a massive, massive device that we would use to replace using rockets to get out of Earth's gravity well. And the problem with using rockets, even though they work quite nicely, is that they're incredibly polluting. Rocket fuel is an incredible contaminant, and so you don't want to be pumping a bunch of it into the environment. And it's also very energy intensive. It's a huge use of resources. It's very expensive. So how do we get people off the planet without polluting the planet and without using up a lot of resources? A space elevator is a device that could do that. And basically all it is a platform that you set up somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, which is attached to a counterweight in space by a long tether. And what would happen is you would have robotic elevator cars that would climb this tether. And they would climb it, oh, maybe say 60,000 miles. So it's way out into space. It's partway to the moon at that point. And once you reach that point, there would be probably a space station or some other kind of port facility where you might get onto another ship and go to your destination, whether that's the moon or our orbital colonies or something we can't even imagine. And the beauty of the space elevator concept, which was actually developed by scientists at NASA in the 1990s, is that it's completely reusable. Your elevator car, which is really kind of more like a bus or a train car, it's quite large and you're going to be sitting in it for a few days while you climb up this tether. You can use it over and over again. You can use it for bringing humans out of the gravity well. You can use it for bringing materials out into space and, of course, back down again onto Earth.
But how long is it going to take to get up there? I mean, I'm thinking about how long it takes the elevator in my building to get to the top floor.
It would take about 3 days. So it'd be a sleeper car. So you pack up and you'd have all of your stuff and, you know, hopefully they'd have okay bathrooms on the space elevator. And, and part of the idea is that you've got the elevators actually being operated by robotic arms that are really just climbing this tether. And the big question is, for scientists, not so much the robotic arms part, which we've got. We actually have robots that can climb ropes. We could easily build a car that was big enough. But what are we going to build this tether out of? We need a strong, light material that can withstand weather and can withstand bombardment with cosmic radiation in space and maybe micrometeorites in space. And right now, the material is believed to be carbon nanotubes. Somehow, we're going to use carbon nanotubes to knit together this amazing tether that connects a counterweight in space 60,000 miles up to a platform on the Earth. And the jury is still out on whether carbon nanotubes are going to do that. It's very, very early days. But it's still an idea that I think is it's good to think about because we need to remember that we can't be depending on rockets forever. Mm. That's going to have to be an interim phase.
Right. So we've talked about geoengineering, but if we're going to colonize other planets, we're going to need to do some human genetic engineering too, won't we, to change ourselves so that we can live in other places?
I think so. I think that's a very difficult idea for people to talk about right now because of all the ethical issues, which are incredibly important. But one of the ways that that scientists are thinking about this is, what would it take to create a human who was more radiation resistant? Because one of the really big issues in space is that you're constantly being bombarded with radiation. And on Earth, we have a really nice magnetic field that really prevents us from getting a lot of the radiation that's just zooming through space all the time. So we're not on the surface of the planet, we're not as much in danger. But once you're in space, you're really exposed. So there are scientists who are thinking about, well, what is it about some people that makes them able to repair their DNA when it's damaged more efficiently than other people? Because some people we suffer from DNA damage all the time. Some of it is from radiation and some of it's from other stuff. But some people's DNA repairs itself better. Mm-hmm. So maybe our first move, if we wanted to tweak humans to be more space worthy, would be to figure out what the genetic characteristics are of people who can really repair their genes well, and start trying to use gene therapy to enhance regular humans that don't necessarily have this super repair ability. And when I say super repair ability, I just mean people who have a better ability to repair their genomes than others.
So we're going to create a genetically altered race of human explorers, I guess, space explorers. So I'm curious, Annalee, at the very end of the book, you pose the question, what will our post-Homo sapiens offspring remember about us? Did you answer the question? What do you think the answer is?
Well, I have a hope of what they will remember about us. And I hope what they remember is kind of like what we remember about our ancestors, you know, Homo erectus, who invented fire and is our immediate ancestor. You know, we think of Homo erectus as being pretty awesome. I mean, I don't know if we would want to have it over for dinner or not. But, you know, Homo erectus used fire. They explored all of Africa and as well as Europe and Asia. They were really the first, early humans to leave Africa. And when Homo sapiens left Africa about, 80,000 years ago or so, they found the descendants of Homo erectus all over Asia. So I think, I hope that we think, you know, that, sorry, let me start that again. I hope that when our future progeny look back on Homo sapiens, they say, wow, I don't know if I'd want to have them over for dinner because they were kind of dirty and, you know, they were really warlike. But, you know, it was so great that they did all that science and exploring that helped us get out here into space and exploring other worlds. And, you know, we've learned a lot since then. And we probably would never want to do what they did back in the 21st century. But, you know, they were a good try. It was a good species, and they did a pretty good job pulling through. And I think that's what my hope is. And, you know, maybe some of our media will survive too, and they can look back at it and laugh at our primitive video files and printed words
and our quaint, silly ways. Annalee, thank you so much for talking today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Okay, that was good. Anything else you want, Doug?
Nope. Okay. Thank you so much. That was just great.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun.
Okay. Take care.
All right. Bye now.